The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys. When Joel first reached out to me about coming here, I think my first words were, "You had me at James K. A. Smith." So I just want to sort of acknowledge up front, I'm a fanboy as much as I'm a speaker here this weekend. I'm excited to be here. What I want to do over the next few minutes is to kind of talk about a lot of the same stuff that Jamie was talking about, but approach it from a couple of different directions, but to sort of continue this conversation of cultural liturgies. How is culture reflecting our desires and our longings? How is it shaping our desires and longings? How is it also shaped by, I think there's an interesting sort of interactive dynamic that we'll talk a little bit about in terms of what exists. But, and to do that, we're going to look at a few specific cultural examples, and we're going to look at the book of Ecclesiastes. Because I think a lot of what's going on when it comes to desire and longing is at the heart of the journey of the teacher in the book of Ecclesiastes. But before we do that, I want to point out one of the things that I think is the most interesting about this conversation, and what was, for me, the most enlightening when I read Desiring the Kingdom, which is that this framework, this idea that that when we're engaging with culture, we're dealing in the realm of imagination, and we're dealing in the realm of our desires, and we're being drawn into different kingdoms, right? That idea is a very foreign framework to the way that I was taught to think about engaging culture when I was a kid, growing up in the church. And an example, sort of a great example of that is the way that you see Christians reacting to a phenomenon like 50 Shades of Grey, right? So right now, all over the country, there are people lining up and spending their $10 and buying movie tickets to watch 50 Shades of Grey. And there's probably an equal number of Christian bloggers, right, writing their blogs about why they shouldn't be doing this. And to me, it's an interesting phenomenon because on the one hand, we're in a weird moral space when it's so necessary to remind Christians you don't want to go do this to yourself and watch this movie. We're in a weird moral and ethical space, I think, for the church, that's even a conversation. But on the other hand, it reminds me that the outcry over that, the uproar over that, is reflective of the way that we see culture and the way we engage it, which is we're most concerned about the surfaces of things. We're most concerned about the content. It's like the overtness of the content, the sexual content. So Christians freak out about sex in movies and violence in movies and nudity and pornography and all this. And again, rightly so. But when you start to think about these cultural liturgies and the way that they work on our desires, the way they work on our imaginations and draw us into new kingdoms, different visions of the world, you start to realize that there is, in a sense, dangerous territory out there that we are completely unaware of how it's working on us and how much of an effect it has on drawing us into these other kingdoms. So with that in mind, we'll start by taking a look at one of my favorite examples of what I think is kind of a cultural liturgy. It's a phenomenon that was very popular, and it's one you might be familiar with. We have an image from it to show you guys here. Now, if you didn't know any better from looking at it, you might be tempted to think that this is actually a scene from a contemporary worship service, right? Like the guy, Ty, what's his face? He kind of looks like Martin Smith from Delirious, you know? Like, I could be convinced. But, as many of you know, this is Extreme Makeover Home Edition. And you know it's proper television, as evidenced by the fact that all the good-looking people are in the front row, right? And so if you're not familiar with the show, here's the thing. I think this is a great thing to think about because there's some really interesting subversive themes going on in the show. The general plot, what happens on the show is they locate a family. And typically it's a family who's endured some kind of hardship. Sometimes they're in conditions of poverty. Sometimes it's like a family who's fostering many, many children. Sometimes it's a family that's been through a fire or a flood or whatever it is. But they tell the story of this family that suffered. And then what happens is a whole community comes together and they bring building supplies and they bring labor and they send the family away for a week and they level their house, and they build in their place, they build their dream home, the home they've wanted all their lives, the home that solves all their problems and answers all of the issues that are plaguing them. And then they bring the family back. And when the family comes back, there's a big bus blocking the view of the house. And the scene that you see here happens right as they're saying, move that bus, right? They say, everybody yells, move that bus, and the bus moves out of the way. And the response from the crowd, from the family, from the TV show's producers, the response that you see can only be described as worship. People fall on their knees, their hands are in the air, they're shouting, they're crying, they're practically saying, woe to me, I'm ruined. Like, here is glory, here is beauty, here is this thing that we have dreamed of and that we long for. And what makes the show powerful, what makes it so identifiable, is two things. One is that, obviously, the sympathy that's natural to feel for a family that suffered like this. But even more so is the power of the image, the power of the icon of the dream home. The arc of the story is a redemption narrative. It's a from the ashes narrative, and redemption comes in the form of a dream home, which is intimately linked to a broader story that we tell as a culture called the American dream. The dream that if you work hard, if you're honest, if you do things right with your life, then you'll make out good. You'll make out well. You'll get what you want. You'll get what you deserve. And the show ends with them moving into their house, and there's this big happy ever after moment as it sort of fades into black. And I think one of the things Jamie said tonight that I think speaks to some of this is, you may not love what you think you love, right? Why do we love this show? Why are we so drawn to this show? Why was it so powerful? Why were the ratings enormous for it for the first few years that it was on? I think it's because that image, that icon of the dream home, that icon of being sort of welcomed into paradise of your own personal little kingdom, had a powerful effect on the audience. Viewers all know before the show ever begins that a dream home is a kind of happy ever after. Long before we've watched the show, we've absorbed that fact. But it's also no mistake that the cameras stop rolling right after the family moves in. Redemption in the form of the house has been achieved. That's the end of the story, right? Well, what I want to talk about tonight, the title of my talk is Choose Your Narratives Carefully. And the idea is that I want us to think about the stories that shape our lives, the stories we engage in our entertainment, and the stories that we're telling ourselves about what's going to make us happy, what's going to make us satisfied, about what we ultimately want. I think this narrative is a great one. This Extreme Makeover is a great one to look at because, like every story you encounter, it's all in the editing. We watch the story happen, and the gorgeous new home seems like the answer to all the problems and all the struggles that this family's had. But with very little research, you can uncover what happens after the cameras stop rolling. Suddenly, a property that was worth $80,000 is worth $400,000 or $500,000, and the tax bill increases accordingly. Likewise, instead of heating and cooling a 1,200-square-foot house with a whole bunch of people packed into it, you're heating and cooling a 4,000, 5,000-square-foot house, and the utilities are exponentially larger. In a large number of cases, the families who were featured on this show were forced within a year or two to foreclose, to sell, to move out of these dream homes. The community that donated the labor and the materials often feels jilted because the homeowner, when they sell, gets a big payoff. They get a six-figure payoff, and it gets ugly from there. I think the show provides a unique opportunity to see a cultural liturgy that actually plays itself out beyond what we think is the end of the story. That we long for this home, we long for this dream, and we're given the dream, we're given what we think we want. And then what happens is disappointing, unsatisfying. It leaves us longing for more. Many of us live our lives and we've got something like this. We've got some dream like this. And sometimes we're conscious of it and sometimes we're not conscious of it, but it's operating all the time. We're thinking to ourselves on some level, you know, if I had this, then I'd be happy. If I could just get that job, if I could just get that career, if I could just get married, if I could just have children, if I could just get my kids to move out of the house, if I could just get a divorce, if I could just get free of this, of a burden, of an addiction, or if I could lose some weight, or if I could do whatever it is, these things that we battle with, and we think, man, if I could just get to that point, then I'd be truly happy. We all have these little promises, these little mini stories that roll around in our minds and propel our lives forward, and we live in pursuit of them, believing that once we've accomplished them, then we're going to be happy. We're going to be able to settle down and have our happy ever after. And these stories are reinforced by cultural stories that we tell, like Extreme Makeover, like dating shows, like The Bachelor. We watch stories, and we watch movies, we watch romantic comedies, and we get this idea reinforced through the stories that our culture is telling that says, you know what, what's going to really satisfy you is love, or is power, or is success, or is victory at war, or is friendship and brotherhood. We tell ourselves these stories, and then we immerse ourselves in the stories as the culture tells them to us as well. And often the aftermath of these stories isn't pretty. The more grim story of Extreme Makeover doesn't make for good primetime television. It's something similar that I've noticed about movies. You can pretty predictably tell what kind of movie you're going to be watching if you know where in the plot line the wedding is. So if the wedding's going to happen at the end of the movie, it's going to be a romantic comedy, right? Like, there's going to be some troubles, and then at the end there's a wedding, and the wedding is the happy ever after. Now, if the wedding is towards the beginning of the movie, and you're going to actually have to watch a marriage, you probably want to bring a box of Kleenexes because it's going to be full of the challenges and the suffering that comes along with marriage. The point being this, we're surrounded by narratives that promise us some kind of ultimate happiness, but they're all in the editing. In real life, if you hang in long enough, whether it's the dream home or a love story, you discover that whatever you've been longing for and living for is a little bit disappointing because, as Woody Allen put it, life itself is a bit unsatisfying. No one knew this better than the author of Ecclesiastes. And the book opens up with the author's kind of mission statement, his vision for what he's going to do. And he says, I've seen all the things that are done under the sun, and all of them are meaningless, a chasing of the wind. When he says under the sun, what he means is, I'm going to go out into the world, and I'm going to experience life just as it appears, just as we can see it. And I'm going to play out these stories to their ends and see what happens. I'm going to experience all the things that people think are going to make them happy, and I'm going to play them out to the very ends. So throughout the book, he pursues it. He pursues money, he pursues power, he pursues sex, he pursues pleasure, he even pursues moral goodness. And he finds that they're all, quote unquote, meaningless. And I actually think the word meaningless maybe isn't the best translation. The actual Hebrew word that he's using there is hebel, and the most literal translation would be something like smoke or vapor. And so it's this idea that these things that you long for, when you pursue them and you live your life for them and you get close to them and try to grasp them, they prove to be frustrating. There's nothing to grab hold of. There's no foundation. There's nothing to cling to. It's frustrating. It's a chasing of the wind. It's not that these things in themselves are worthless. They're good, but if you actually chase them down, you won't find satisfaction in them for the long haul. He finds that good people don't necessarily get ahead, that bad people don't necessarily get the justice they deserve, that hard work doesn't pay off, that life is full of random chance and disappointment. Each one of these things that the teacher pursues is, in itself, kind of a vision of the good life. These are the stories that we're telling in our culture about what's going to make us happen. It's why millions of people will go out and spend money on lottery tickets next weekend, because the million-to-one shot of getting it is worth the chance that if I just got that money, I could make everything okay in my life. And I think these things that he pursues, these desires that he pursues, one of the ways I like to kind of think about it is this is our default programming. Right? We're immersed in a world that's telling stories and giving us visions of the good life that because we've been immersed in them for our whole lives, we don't even realize how drawn to them we are. We don't even realize how drawn to money, power, and sex all of us are. But we are. And you can tell we are by the fact that the entertainment industry continues to hold them out for us and thrive. Because we're in. Our imagination is hooked. We're hooked. To quote James K. A. Smith. A helpful phrase, I think, in this discussion is just this idea of spiritual formation. You often hear that word associated with Christian practices like worship and spiritual disciplines. To be spiritually formed means to have the things that you love shaped and directed towards some end. In the church, it means being conformed to the image of Jesus. As Dallas Willard put it, it means learning to live your life as he would were he in your place. But in the world at large, spiritual formation is nonetheless happening all the time. Our cultural liturgies are orienting us towards other loves. And the mission of the teacher was to search out these other loves, to see what they offer. And he tells us that they're smoke and they're vapor and they're frustrating. In Ecclesiastes, the teacher ruins the end of all of our cultural stories. One of my favorite passages in the book comes towards the end where he begins to sort of summarize the project. Starting in verse 10, he actually says that the preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. And it's a funny passage because if you look at the book, if you look at what he's talking about, he's talking about, you know, love is great, but you're going to die. Money and power are great, but they fade, or the money, people can steal your money and it disappears. It's a really depressing book. And as he's wrapping up, he says, the preacher sought to find words of delight. And there's a little bit of debate about exactly what that means, but some people think it's a reference to the poetry itself. But I actually think the better understanding of that is that he's essentially saying, look, I tried to make this as pleasant for you as I could. I tried to make this as palatable for you as I could. But this is the truth. This is just simply how things are, and there's no getting around it. The passage continues and says that the words of wisdom are like goads. They're collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. In that passage, he's giving us two visions of what wisdom is supposed to do as an alternative to all these cultural stories. What does wisdom offer us? And he says it offers us goads and firmly embedded nails. A goad is something that a shepherd would carry, and he would spur on sheep along as he's trying to shepherd them along. So you'd goad them along. You'd poke them with a stick, essentially. So there's something about wisdom that's supposed to propel us forward in our lives. And there's something about wisdom as well that's like firmly embedded nails. And when he says firmly embedded nails, he means something like tent stakes. So it's almost like saying he plants us, he gives us roots, but he also gives us wings. He also propels us forward. Wisdom is supposed to be rooting us in something firm and propelling us forward into life. What exactly does that mean? How does that propel us? How does wisdom propel us and root us? How does knowing that all of life is frustrating and that these stories that we've been living for are all disappointing, how does that propel us and root us? Well, I think first off, it roots us so that we won't be surprised. If you listen to the teacher and you flip on the TV and you watch Extreme Makeover Home Edition, you know that the ending credits is not the end of the story and that there's trouble to come, because that's just how life goes. That wealth fades, that power fades, that the joy and the pleasures that we have are good, that those are good moments, but that they fade. And as cruel as his words may seem, what's worse? Believing that life can be satisfying the way that we're living it? Believing that we can be happy with money or sex if we only get enough of it? We'll die frustrated and miserable, as many, many people do, if we think these things are supposed to fulfill us. It's hard to hear that the thing that we've been living for and worshiping are ultimately going to leave us feeling empty, but it's worse to go on believing that and never hear the truth. And frankly, if you want to know what the opposite of the book of Ecclesiastes is, it's all around us. Do you know what the counterexample of meaningless is? It's images of new cars and new houses. It's beer commercials and shows on the Travel Channel and the Food Network. It's every transcendent promise made by marketers that overpromises and underdelivers. One of my favorite commercials that I've seen in the last couple of years was one. It was on during NFL games this last fall and maybe a little before that. But it's a Ford truck commercial, and It's just a beautifully shot commercial where this older guy has this big Ford crew cab truck, and he's got his friends with him, and he's driving through the desert, and it's all painted in amber light. I mean, it's just beautifully done. And there's this beautiful music playing, and then a voiceover comes, and it's kind of like a gritty cowboy voice. And he says, a man and his truck, a man in a truck and some company. And 4 hard landings and 3 sore vertebrae and 2 hours to drive home and make it all melt away. And that's the whole commercial, right? For a truck. It tells us nothing about the truck. See, I think it's a perfect example of what we've been talking about tonight, of a vision of the good life. And what advertisers are doing is they're holding out, in this case, they're holding out this truck and they're going, see, here's a way of living that's open to you if you would just go down to the bank, get yourself a loan, and go buy a new Ford F-150. A vision of the good life, a life that's masculine, a life that's surrounded by friends, a life of adventure, a life of, at the end of the day, where you feel like you've done something and you've accomplished something. And it's all communicated in sort of images and subtle ideas. It's all communicated aiming directly at your heart and not at your head. If they communicated at your head in that way, you'd go, that's ridiculous. But they don't. And so the commercial works. Commercial works great. When the first time I ever saw the commercial, I kind of had a flashback to this moment right after I got married. where I had a truck and it was giving me some trouble, and my in-laws were coming over to the house, and so I'm out in the driveway, and I'm under the hood of the truck trying to, I think I was changing a belt or something like this. And I'm working on the truck, and my father-in-law comes walking up, and he's asking me what's going on. And ironically, Dale Huff is like, my father-in-law is about 6'2", real skinny, very cowboy-looking. Like, he's had a mustache before, like, most hipsters were born, you know? He means it. And he's got a voice like the guy in the Ford commercial, except he's got, like, this Hoosier drawl to it. And so we're leaning over the truck, and we're talking, and he says to me, after we talked about the thing and I'm complaining about having to work on the car, and he says, "Mike, I've learned a few things in this life, and one of them is that you live and you die, and in between you got to work on cars." And Dale is legendary for driving cars like right up to the moment, you know that moment at the end of the Blues Brothers when they shut the car doors and the car falls apart? Like, if that would happen for Dale, he would be the happiest man in the world, because he would know, I got every penny's worth out of that car. Like, one story here I'm going to tell it anyway. So my wife, when she was in junior high, she tells this story all the time, that one morning they were driving to school, and he had this Dodge that he had just about driven to the brink of despair. And they're pulling out of their driveway, and they live about a mile and a half from the middle school. He backs out of the driveway, and he puts it into drive, and you hear this horrible ratcheting, grinding sound as all the teeth on the gears in the transmission just shear right off, right? So he's got no forward gear, and they're like almost late to school, and he's trying to figure out what to do, and he kind of does the math. He's like a mile and a half. He throws it into reverse. The only gear he's got left drives him to school and home in reverse. Now again, think about it. Somebody who's selling you a car is selling you a car with a vision of the good life. Look at the life this car invites you to, right? And it's a lie. Yeah, you can go drive out in the desert, but that also means you're going to be under the hood of that thing when it's time to change the belts, or you're going to be driving it backwards to and from school when you're rushing to get your kids there. Because these things that give us joy, these consumer pleasures especially, these things that give us joy, the joy they give us is so brief and so disappointing, and it's like vapor, it's like smoke. You turn around, and it's gone. Sex is another great example of this, where the culture is telling us that it's the great hope for civilization. In every arena, sex is being marketed, being sold, being promoted, being exalted, being worshipped. I was in the grocery store the other day, and literally, there were 6 magazines up there. 2 of them were for men, 4 of them were for women, and every one of them had a promise on the front cover of the best sex you've ever had in your life inside this magazine. They promise us better practices, a myriad of solutions. Movies culminate in sexual encounters that change people's lives. Everything from weight loss products to cheeseburgers is sold with sex. Pornography is more pervasive than ever, and we've already mentioned 50 Shades of Grey. No need to go there again. Our world believes in sex as a functional savior. If we can get enough of it, or if we can get it right, if it can be good enough, then we will be truly satisfied. We'll know who we are. We'll be settled. But that's not how sex works, as the teachers told us, and as experience echoes. If you talk to anybody who's tried to live this life out and tried to find satisfaction in it, they almost invariably echo the teacher's language, that it's empty, that it's unsatisfying. And you know what? Christians are guilty of this too. Christian marriage is often marketed as a way to have the hottest, the most passionate, the only truly satisfying sex. Pastors write books on sex techniques, host chat shows on them from the beds on the roof of their building, and talk about their smoking hot wives. Frankly, one of the most disturbing things about looking at cultural liturgies is that you'll discover that Christians are often just as guilty in participating in the worst of them, promising satisfaction in sex, money, or power by sprinkling a little holy water on the thing. And no wonder so many Christians are burned out on the church. We show up in the church and we find that we're promising the same things the world is promising. Better sex, better marriages, better management of our money. You'll be wealthy, you'll be healthier, you'll be more satisfied in your love and in your marriage and in your home. Wisdom seeks to root us in something more dependable. It gives us a world in which sex isn't the answer to our problems, and likewise, neither is power, success, or even moral goodness. It goads us to look for something else and roots us into something that can actually hold us onto. And he tells us what that is in verse 13. He says, all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it's good or evil. You know, as I grew up in the church, another thing I heard oftentimes is that anytime you encounter the idea of the fear of God, we were kind of shooed away from that as being like fear. Like, it's not actually fear. It's more like, kind of like, you just have to have a healthy respect for God. And yet, this is the God who Paul refers to as the one who is immortal and who lives in inapproachable light. This is the God who Isaiah calls holy, 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 which in Hebrew literature, to repeat it three times is like saying holy to the power of holy to the power of holy. One of my favorite stories on the holiness of God is the story of Uzzah, who after the Ark of the Covenant had been stolen by the Philistines, he's overseeing it being returned. Israel's conquered the Philistines, and they're taking the Ark back to Jerusalem. And the Ark, of course, is the place where God's presence shows up. It's like the most sacred object in all of Israel. And everybody knows, you don't touch the Ark, right? And so he's having it transported back to Jerusalem, and he's got it on an ox cart, which is already breaking a rule. He shouldn't have had it on an ox cart, but he does. And the scriptures tell us that as this is happening, one of the oxen stumbles, and Uzzah reaches out his hand to stabilize the thing, and he drops dead the second he touches it. And you know what? Most of us, we hear that story, and we go, gosh, that's kind of harsh. Like, God, I mean, we get you're holy, but I mean, don't we want to, like, he's concerned. He's concerned the thing's going to fall. It's going to fall in the dirt. And I'll never forget this story because I heard R.C. Sproul preach on this passage. And he said, you know, the sin of Uzzah was in thinking that his hands were cleaner than the dirt. The author of Hebrews says it's a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. For all these reasons, I think when we hear the word fear, we do need to think in the category of fear and trembling. We are venturing into unfamiliar territory in his presence. And, you know, the Oprah-fied kind of sensibility of saying, well, you won't really mean fear, it just means a healthy respect. Behind that is this idea that we have to sort of banish fear from the conversation and banish fear from our lives. And I think what that misses out on, as much as anything else, is it misses out on the reality that fear is already massively influencing your lives. The truth is that most people's lives are lived in fear of something. It drives the way we live and the way we think and our stories and our futures. Look at your life right now. Go back to that fill in the blank we were talking about earlier. If I had this, then I'd be happy. What's behind that oftentimes is a fear of something. Whatever you're living for, you'll discover that is the thing that you fear the most. If you think money will make you happy, maybe you're living in fear of poverty. Do you think fame and popularity will make you happy? You fear the opinions of others. You're living for success. Maybe you fear failure. If you go into all the areas of your life where you find stress or anger or anxiety, these emotions are always secondary to some deeper sense of fear or shame. What if people don't like me? What if no one can love me? What if I'm really at my core, I'm just a loser and a failure? Behind so much of our culture, so many of our stories, so much of our consumerism and our acting out and our addictions are a collection of fears about who we are and why we're here and what life is supposed to mean. And it's frightening. The world is a frightened and an unsettled place, full of sadness and anxiety and fear. Grant Morrison is a comic book writer, and he's written a couple of great books, a great book called Super Gods. And in the book, one of the things he talks about is how shifts in history and in culture in the 20th century are reflected in the sort of the lives of the comic books. And the big fear, the great fear that sort of emerged in the early to mid-20th century was the fear of the atomic bomb. And this reality that we had created something that literally could destroy the world. And he says, what's so interesting is that in our comics, in our myths that galvanized the comic industry, especially in the 1960s, all of these heroes that emerged were heroes that had some kind of relationship to the atom, some kind of relationship to the sun, or some kind of relationship to radioactivity, like Spider-Man being bitten by a radioactive spider, or the mutants where radioactivity had changed their genes. There's a fear that drives us to go, I've got to tell a story that's going to enable me to deal with my fear. I've got to tell a story that's going to provide me some sense of hope that whatever this thing that I'm afraid of is going to get satisfied one way or the other. Morrison writes, before it was a bomb, the bomb was an idea. Superman was a faster, stronger, better idea. You see it in Spider-Man and the Atom Bomb, and you see it in the 90s with Neo in the Matrix. As the internet's blowing up and as this new sense of connectivity is coming up, suddenly a hero comes, a human being who, by the power of his own soul and spirit, can overcome the internet. I think this fear that drives our culture is what Jacques Lacan, a psychologist, was getting at when he developed his idea of the big other. Lacan's idea was that as we all grow up, as we develop, starting from infants, we nurture a certain kind of primitive fear that comes to play a dominant role in our lives. There's some kind of authority to which we're always beholden, always fearful, always dodging. It's always there, a simmering anxiety that we can't quite get away from. And what Lacan thought was the cure for this anxiety was exactly what the teacher thought. He thought it was the fear of God. This is what Lacan says. He says, this famous fear of God accomplishes a sleight of hand feat, transforming all fears into perfect courage in an instant. All fears are exchanged for the fear of God, however constraining it may be. It's the opposite of fear. See, the fear of God is a fear that's more powerful and frightful than any others. It's what Tim Keller calls the fear that ends all fears. And that's not merely because this is a God who will judge the living and the dead, though I certainly think that's a factor. Rather, it's the fear that ends all fears because it reveals them to be mere shadows. It reveals these things that we've longed for and that we've been seeking after to be a shadow of what is offered in the presence of God. The satisfaction we long for, the pleasures we long for in sex or in power or in glory, they don't last. And yet God offers us a communion that is more deep and more powerful than the world can. God offers us a satisfaction, a sense of identity, a sense of love and acceptance that we're all craving. It's the thing, I love C.S. Lewis's phrase for it, it's the door we've been knocking on for all of our lives. The fear of God is not merely an abstraction then, it's a practical reality, and it's something we can choose to live in. And by choosing, I don't mean we simply walk an aisle and fill out a card saying, now I'm choosing to live in the fear of God. But I also don't mean something that's terribly far off from that. Ultimately, living in the fear of God means making the choice to fear God again and again, and putting ourselves in circumstances that remind us of why we make that choice. These cultural liturgies are a program of spiritual formation. There are default programming, one that comes from the idol factory of the human heart. To live in the fear of God then means we choose to reprogram our hearts and our minds. And that will happen much like formation happened in the first place, slowly, over time, in ways that are intentional, like choosing to attend church and practice spiritual disciplines, and in ways that are more subtle as we live in community with others who are in the journey with us, making those same choices. We've spent our whole lives telling ourselves these stories of these things that we think would make us happy and these things that would make us be satisfying, but what most of these stories guide us to and hope for disappoints us. What the teacher invites us into is a hope that won't perish, the fear that ends all fears, a story where the ending's already been sealed and guaranteed by Jesus. It's hope for another kind of world and not merely one where we get to, not merely one that we'll experience one fine day when Jesus returns, but a world that we experience now because, as Jesus tells us, the kingdom is here. The kingdom is at hand. And you know, the great irony of the scriptures is that the God who we're called to fear is also the God whose perfect love casts out fear. He's the God who sends his son to die a sinner's death and to reconcile us to himself. He's the God who sends his spirit to dwell in our hearts and enable us to live in another world, to serve another king and kingdom. And we learn to do that as we tell that story again and again and find our own stories in its midst. And I think that's where we'll pick things up starting tomorrow. Thanks for being with me.